City Hall is getting serious about resiliency. What will that mean for some of Jacksonville's most vulnerable neighborhoods? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a look at how to bring environmental justice to Jacksonville. What is that? Give us a call now with your questions. It's 549-2937. Then later, filling the audio void with some local musical stars. And we've got some exciting news for the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp. That's all ahead. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID pandemic. The U.S. recorded more than 3,000 COVID-19 deaths in a single day yesterday. That set a terrible record, according to a Washington Post analysis. Meanwhile, the Florida Department of Health's latest report shows an increase of 9,592 cases in 24 hours. On Wednesday, the state reported 84 new deaths around Florida, bringing the cumulative total to 19,462. And also of note, the COVID-19 test site at Regency Square Mall in Jacksonville will be closed today due to a power outage. According to the Florida Association of Public Information Officers, a transformer blew in the area and the facility is not having power today. So if you were planning to get a COVID test today over there, you can't do it today. Please be noting that. All right, let's move on to some other news today. Recently, the city of Jacksonville decided to get serious about resiliency. Now, we are way behind the curve and way behind most other Florida cities on this, about 10 years, in fact. But it's still good news because we are a coastal Florida city that is facing real and serious impacts from climate change and sea level rise in the coming decades. Part of becoming a more resilient city also means understanding what's known as environmental justice. This Friday, a City Council Special Committee on Resilience will meet at City Hall, and all of this will be on the agenda. In a few moments, we will welcome to the show Josh Gellers, PhD. He's a lead green associate presenting Friday to the Jacksonville City Council Special Committee on Resilience, along with the EPA. We are hoping to have him on the show soon where we talk about environmental justice, the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of everyone, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income. And that deals with the implementation and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. This is a big problem for Jacksonville because over the years, some neighborhoods have not really been treated fairly. They've been dumping grounds for pollution and environmental waste. And so basically, the City Hall Resiliency Committee is going to be asked to incorporate principles of environmental justice and take a holistic approach to this. We're having trouble connecting, Josh, so we're going to hopefully get to this later in the hour and get to your calls about that as well. So while we wait on him to connect with us, we're going to skip ahead in the rundown and talk about some other things, beginning with a fascinating interview that I recorded yesterday, and it has to do with the South and Hollywood. Now, this new book is a celluloid trip through Hollywood's longtime fascination with the South. Author Ben Beard looks at the way movies tell stories about this region of the country and why Hollywood so often gets it wrong. I spoke with him about his new book. It's called The South Never Plays Itself. Take a listen.
Ben, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a film buff, and you know a lot about the South, having lived down in our area for a while in Florida. What motivated you to explore the way Hollywood looks at the South?
Well, I was a writer writing novels that no one seemed interested in reading, and I love movies, and I was reviewing them. I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was thinking about how the South on screen was just never anywhere near the South that I grew up in, which was beachy, a little druggy, laid back, and about 1,000 miles from what we normally got on screen. So I started kind of compiling mentally different movies that, I don't know, seemed to reflect reality or were, you know, part of some mythological Southern past that probably never
existed. So why do you think filmmakers have such a difficult time depicting this part of the country accurately then?
Well, I think the South's not one thing, right? It's a bunch of different regions, a bunch of different areas that have nothing in common with each other except that 100-something years ago they fought in the Civil War against the Union. So Memphis has nothing to do with Miami. Jacksonville has nothing to do with Jackson, Mississippi, or very little. But I think filmmakers often approach the South as not quite another country. Almost like it's another country, but not quite. And they miss the nuances, both in the dialect, which is often a criticism, right? That the accents are just wrong, but also that the people are all racist or uneducated or undereducated, that everyone lives on farms and
Yeah. Okay, now let me ask you about your chapter on Florida movies. You call it the Florida Experiment, where you talk about everything from Magic Mike to Scarface to The Birdcage to Key Largo, Cool Hand Luke. And you say in this chapter that you grew up in Florida and you have yet to fully recover. So what do you, let's begin with that. What do you mean by that?
I grew up in Pensacola, Florida, which is a collision of, like, the military, beach bums, hippies, super religious people, which I used to be one. There's also, like, some South Alabama feel. So you have all these different strands. And I didn't really fit comfortably in any of them. Also, it was hot all the time, except for, like, a month in January. And so there was very little change in the seasons. And I just think Florida is, it should be four states, right? But it's, you know, it's supposed to be funny when I say that, but it's partially the religious belief system clashing against the, like, beachy hedonism, you know, for me. But most of the great films about the South are in Florida or Texas.
And why do you think those are the two states that tend to be the locations for most of the big Southern films?
I think they're the most complex. They're the biggest. They're also very sunny, and that makes shooting outside, you can shoot outside for longer. And I think Florida attracts people because it's got Disney World. It's got Miami, which has its own flavor. It has all the beaches. It has environmental disasters. It has corrupt politicians and larger-than-life figures. And Texas basically has the same thing, plus oil. And I think that attracts storytellers. And a lot of the Florida movies, I think, actually get it quite right. I think Magic Mike, you mentioned, which is a great film. The second one's a disaster, but the first one's great. And if you watch the film but, like, look behind the characters at the locales and kind of, you know, almost like it's a character itself, the South, the Tampa that they're filming, that's close to what I experienced growing up, the look and the feel of it.
Yeah, it does kind of capture that vibe. So do you have a favorite film about the South, or the one that's set in the South out of all the ones that you talk about in the book?
Well, I mean, I have a lot of movies that I like. I think if I were going to hone in on, like, Southern religious beliefs, I would pick Junebug, which has a British woman who marries a guy from North Carolina, and she goes back to his hometown with him to meet his family and discovers that they're all very religious, but her husband has, like, a deep connection to these religious beliefs that he doesn't present or represent when he's in New York City. And it's a very fine film about the South, and it feels real to me. Cool Hand Luke is great. It's a classic, but it could have been set anywhere that's hot, basically, in a way. And again, Magic Mike is wonderful. About Florida films, you know, Cocoon is kind of fun because it has these old people who become reinvigorated. It has them sort of tap dancing and dancing around strip malls of Florida. And it also feels true to me.
Cocoon is one of my favorites, too. Yeah, that is a great one. Now, let me ask you, because on the cover of your book, the full title is The South Never Plays Itself, A Film Buff's Journey Through the South on Screen, From Birth of a Nation to Green Book. And if we go all the way back to 1915 and D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, of course, that was a notoriously racist film. Then coming up to our era, Green Book, which also told a story about race and the South in a very different way. You can't really talk about the South in Hollywood without race. And so how do you think Hollywood has handled that through the years? And what, in your view, should they be doing to tell those stories better and more accurately?
Well, Hollywood is a... You know, it was founded by immigrants from Eastern Europe who had fled oppression and violence. But they, I think for commercial purposes, glommed on to an American story that really did leave out Black Americans. Most of those early Hollywood films, they have no interest in talking about marginalized or oppressed people at all, and Black Americans they're relegated to the background. They're porters and maids and stuff, and it's terrible. And Birth of a Nation gave us the first blockbuster, and it gave us a lot of money that went to form Hollywood, and it also gave us stereotypes and a terrible history, and you know, we have to deal with that. Movie fans have to deal with that. I think we're in the middle of a renaissance of Black filmmakers and writers and artists, and have been for a couple of years. And I think the way Hollywood can kind of make it right, what they did, their mistakes in the past, is to put money into Black filmmakers and let them tell stories. Queen and Slim, which mm-hmm. was a really good film about a Black couple on the run, and they end up, you know, in the panhandle and kind of fleeing through the South, I thought was marvelous. The TV show Atlanta, which, you know, it's great, it's funny, it's strange, it's uncompromising, and it does kind of capture Atlanta quite well. And I think that's the first step. Is to invest in Black artists. And it is happening. Green Book is interesting because people went crazy over that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And winning Best Picture, it matters, and it doesn't matter at all, I think. Green Book, to me, makes a number of mistakes, but the main one is Viggo Mortensen's character, the movie likes him more.
Right.
Than the pianist.
Right.
And it's weird. And the movie kind of makes the argument that he's blacker than Ali's character because he likes soul music, and it's just tone deaf in 2019. Yeah.
Yeah, and it certainly did get some pushback for those items that you mentioned. So, I mean, how much responsibility do you think the entertainment business has to tell stories about the South accurately? Because as you note in the book, these myths and these sort of false narratives about the South they've kind of done some harm through the years.
I think they've done harm to our country. I think the worst, it's going to be a funny thing to say, but the South is seen as it's a repository for all of America's racial sins, right? So if you're a Southerner on screen, you're most likely racist. But in my experience, I grew up in the South, I live in Chicago now, that's actually not the case. There's racism everywhere, and the idea that the rest of the country's off the hook, I think has allowed us to not work through some of these issues that we really should have worked through a long time ago. And so that's one, it's a bad thing that the movies have given us. It's it's simplistic, and it doesn't help anybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the Gone with the Winds and that kind of the pre-lapsarian South before the Civil War, that it was all wonderful. I mean, it's terrible history, and it hurts. It hurts everybody. It lets people think that slavery wasn't that bad, and that distorts any conversation we can have about reparations or healing, and it leaves out a lot of Americans out of the American story.
It's fascinating to talk to you. This is such an interesting book, and it's out now, so I encourage everyone to pick it up. It's a great gift for the movie lover in your life. The book is The South Never Plays Itself, A Film Buff's Journey Through the South on Screen, by author Ben Beard. Ben, thanks for getting on the phone with us, and have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too.
Let's get back now to the resiliency discussion. On Friday, the City Council Special Committee on Resiliency meets, and environmental justice will be one of the presentations they will absorb. It will be given by Josh Gellers, PhD, lead green associate. He will be talking about this concept of environmental justice at City Hall Friday. What is that all about? We'll go to your calls in a few minutes at 549-2937. But right now, Josh is on the line. Hey, Josh. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you on the show. Let's begin by noting that the City Council is getting serious about resiliency efforts for the city of Jacksonville, better late than never. So let's begin with that. What are your thoughts about these new efforts by city officials and also in the private sector we're seeing to have a serious conversation in this city about resiliency?
Well, I think there's just a lot of momentum right now around addressing resiliency issues, especially in light of some of the impacts we've seen over the past 2 years with respect to hurricanes, flooding areas. You know, the famous picture now from Riverside Memorial Park, which looks like the city is inundated in the middle of an ocean, to parts of San Marco and downtown that were also underwater. And so I think it's really a good step forward that there's a consensus among members of the City Council that this is something we need to take seriously, not only for the immediate future of Jacksonville, but planning, you know, decades ahead.
Right. And so you will be presenting to this committee Friday at City Hall, talking about the concept of environmental justice and how they need to factor this into any legislation that they move through. What is environmental justice?
So the EPA provides a pretty good definition, and it is that environmental justice is the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. And it covers a lot of ground, but basically the idea is that there are three prongs to ensuring that no one is left behind in these conversations about resilience: participation, recognition, and distribution, which is sort of the main plank that a lot of people are aware of, which is kind of an homage to the beginning of the environmental justice, which was then called the environmental racism issue back in the 1980s. And it was this idea that there were disproportionate impacts, especially affecting communities of color and low-income communities where there are environmental problems, whether they're involving the location of toxic waste sites or where chemical effluents are spreading and so on. So that really begat this this concept in the United States. And in the early, during the early part of the Clinton administration, we set up an office to specifically address environmental justice issues. And I'm really fortunate that I'm going to be joined on Friday by a member of the EPA, Ms. LaTanya Spencer, who has done a lot of work in Jacksonville and is going to provide some resources on how to apply for grants so that people can address environmental injustices.
What are some examples from this city's past that we could look to so people can get an understanding of how this played out in Jacksonville over the years?
So there's a couple of examples that come to mind. The first one is what was called Brown's Dump, which was a place where the city had put incinerator ash and all kinds of waste onto a site. And then the site was acquired by the city, and they developed a school, an elementary school there, Bethune Elementary, without remediating the site first. And so this caused a lot of outcry in the community, and it wasn't, this was going back to the 1950s, by the way, and it wasn't until 2010 when Jacksonville said that they were going to remediate the site and clean it up and everything like that. And so that was probably one of the most prominent environmental justice issues earlier into the 20th century. And then more recently, the issue at Eureka Gardens is definitely another example of an environmental injustice in that You had people living in housing that was dilapidated, that was poisonous, and then nothing was being done about it. And, of course, that community is predominantly African-American, predominantly low-income, and so the idea is that these people were being overlooked and their problems were not being adequately addressed, and that animates concerns that it was an environmental justice problem.
And, of course, in communities that have dealt with these issues through the years, people that live in them are at higher risk of illness, higher risk of early death.
Yes, I mean, so one of the important aspects of environmental justice that we're going to convey on Friday is that this is not just about the distribution of environmental harms or environmental goods like public parks, but it's really something that is very comprehensive, very holistic in the way that it needs to be addressed. And if you go back to what I'm going to show this on Friday, so I have a couple slides on it, but the 1991 Environmental Justice Principles, which grew out of the National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit in Washington, D.C., you see a wide-ranging a number of concerns that have something to do with the origins of environmental justice, and those include things like healthcare disparities, disparities in educational attainment. So it's not just about, are people located close to a, you know, a hazardous waste facility, but what are the actual capabilities that people have, and are those being frustrated by systemic conditions in society?
Okay, and let's go to some calls now for Josh Gellers in advance of his talk at City Hall tomorrow on environmental justice. What are your questions about this? It's 549-2937. John on the South Side. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you, Melissa?
Great.
I had a comment to make in regards to environmental resiliency here in Jacksonville. If people want to make Jacksonville more environmentally resilient, they should put pressure on JEA to change their net metering policy in regards to solar. JEA is very not solar friendly at all. That's why in JEA territory you don't see any solar panels or very, very few. But as soon as you cross over the line and see the neighborhoods literally right on the other side in Clay County territory, you see solar everywhere. So that was my comment.
Okay, yeah, thank you, John. Josh,
that's a really excellent point.
Yeah, go ahead and share what you think about that.
So several years ago, I was part of a public meeting that specifically addressed this issue. It was held at Jacksonville University, and there were people from JEA present, but they didn't participate in the event. And the long and short of it is this: Florida is one of the top states in the country for solar potential, and yet because of our laws, whether they're at the local municipal level or even at the state level, we don't have the same opportunity to develop solar technology and to make it widely available. So that's why you see these movements like community solar emerging, because they try and get around the fact that there are energy companies that are kind of, you know, being like a stick in the mud and not allowing it's an interesting issue, because you have, on the one hand, environmentalists who clearly see that this is the wave of the future and we should be moving in the direction of renewable energy. And then you have even people like libertarians who think that this is a matter of individual freedom. And it should be that each individual person has the opportunity to, you know, perhaps develop their own energy resources the way that they see fit, especially if that involves cutting the cord from these large utility companies. And so it's one of the few environmental issues that brings together people across the spectrum. And yeah, JEA has been they have not pursued this particular issue with the kind of gusto that we see in other places like Clay County. So there's definitely a lot of room for improvement there.
Okay, so what else is on your radar about this? Because it's interesting to see that not only is this Committee on Resiliency meeting, there's also a committee on social justice addressing longstanding inequities in the city, infrastructure improvements that are needed. All of these things tend to go hand in hand in terms of lifting up underserved communities in Jacksonville.
Absolutely. And so one of the things that we're hoping to do on Friday is to show how those connections exist between social justice. I mean, even literally, I have a slide that shows how environmental justice relates to the larger project of trying to ensure social justice for all. And so we hope that's going to be an important beginning of a conversation about not just how can we mitigate flooding that occurs on occasion here in Jacksonville, but how can we address some of the structural inequities like food deserts, which I know you've discussed on your show, that have an impact on people's lived experiences, their daily lives, and their ability to experience and enjoy social justice. So I see these things as obviously connected, and I hope that they will help to kind of bridge the gap between what we see as sort of discrete environmental challenges on the one hand, and then social justice challenges on the other.
On Facebook, Hope writes, environmental justice and resiliency need to be concerned with the holistic needs of the people, as well as the infrastructure supports required in a time of climate change. We are already a city of people displaced by environmental issues. With not near enough money being invested in safe housing, pollution mitigation, etc., we have much ground to make up for with little time to do so. Josh Gellers, let's talk about the timetable. Jacksonville is behind most other large Florida cities in even looking at this problem and figuring out what to do about it. We are looking at a shortened time frame to protect this city against long-term negative environmental impacts posed by rising waters and rising temperatures. So how much urgency do you plan to communicate in your talk?
I mean, I think that's a real central aspect of the message, is that, you know, we have this opportunity now where the community is coming together to discuss these issues. We're planning on hiring a chief resiliency officer, which is someone who's going to work, cross agencies throughout the city. And our idea that we're trying to express is that, you know, the time was before and it is now, and so we can't really delay in making sure that these sorts of problems are going to be adequately addressed at the highest level in our city. And so I completely agree with Hope's comment that this is something that needs to be of a great concern in terms of the time horizon. And, you know, some of it is, as I mentioned, with respect to even something like flooding, which is only one piece of the larger puzzle of environmental challenges that we face in the city. But is the fact that, you know, these things are already happening. This is not a matter of, well, we need to plan our infrastructure for, you know, one in 1,000-year flooding events. Now, we've experienced those flooding events already, so part of this involves infrastructure changes and development. Part of this involves, you know, how can we make people more resilient as opposed to just, you know, the built environment. It's a really, again, I agree that it's a holistic challenge that needs to be addressed now, which is why I hope, you know, we are going to have a lot of momentum moving forward with, this resiliency issue. And then making sure that on our part, we're going to see the forest for the trees here, and we're not going to overlook some of these other systemic issues that people are facing, because they're all really connected.
It's 549-2937. As we talk about resiliency efforts and the concept of environmental justice in the city of Jacksonville, Kay in Jacksonville. Hi, Kay. Good morning.
Good morning. Don't take anything personal, not you, Melissa, I'm talking about the guy that's on. I don't want him to take anything personal, but for almost 80 years, we've been having resiliency programs. They were called other names, but they were still the same game. But we black people didn't see no progress. That's why people are in the street. That's why Black Lives Matter exists. Because there's always somebody talking about it. There's always somebody showing inequities in writing, on paper, in meetings, but nothing is done in the communities. So I just would like to ask this young man, I know he's doing the best he can. He's only part of the system. But what is people going to see today, this month, this year? Black people, that is. Brown people, yellow people. What will we see as progress this year?
Kay, I know. You're absolutely right. Folks in this town have been waiting a long time. And, I really appreciate you giving voice to that. So, Josh, there's so much cynicism in Duval about the system's ability to really make a meaningful impact in neighborhoods that have been neglected for so many years. And this goes beyond the environmental piece. So, you know, what are your thoughts about that? Because it is frustrating, I think, for people to see presentations given, to have city officials know what the issues are, and then so often no meaningful action be taken.
I mean, I do not take the comment personally. In fact, I've only been here for just over 6 years. And in that time, I've tried to elevate the issue of environmental problems that the city is facing. And so I agree completely with the caller's comment, and I want to thank her for providing that insight and to legitimate the fact that that is the lived experience for a lot of people in the community. One thing that I think makes this a bit different than before is the fact that we're going to have someone who is a top official in the city with a 30,000-foot view of things that need to be done. And that person is going to be charged with resiliency for everyone, not just for the south side, not just for the, you know, toward the beaches areas, but the north side, the west side, and so on. And, you know, and on a practical note, in my presentation, I'm going to provide some recommendations for specific language tethered to the objective of advancing environmental justice that I hope will make its way into city ordinances. And then also on another practical note, Ms. Spencer from the EPA is going to be talking about grants that are available specifically to address environmental injustices. And she has worked in this community for a long time. And so she has a great deal of insight about what it's like on the ground and the kinds of resources that are available today. I mean, if you go to the EPA's website and you look for environmental justice grants, there are plenty of them, and we would certainly be eligible to pursue them. So I think, you know, we hope to provide some practical steps that can be utilized throughout the city to change some of the tenor of things that have been going on over the past several decades. And I'm completely sympathetic to the caller's plight for change that is going to be equitable and today. And I really sincerely hope that with the energy that we have in city council and in the special committee on resiliency, that we will finally be able to get these things done in a concerted fashion.
Thank you for that. And this is a public meeting. People can attend. Can you give the details?
Sure.
They can virtually attend, I should say. Go ahead.
All different ways. So you can attend in person. In part, it's going to be hybrid. You can attend by calling in through Zoom. You can attend by streaming it live through the COJ.net website, where you can just watch it on your computer. Or you can also watch it and be a participant if you log in through Zoom. And the information for all of that is provided on COJ.net. If you just search the Special Committee on Resiliency, it is the December 11th meeting. And so all the information.
And what time is it?
2:30 p.m.
Okay.
On Friday, December 11th.
All right, Josh. Josh Geller is with us. Thank you for all of this information. Sorry we couldn't get every caller on the line. Lots of interest in this. And we look forward to more.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Josh.
I appreciate it, Melissa.
Okay, much more still ahead. Later in the hour, we'll listen to Audio Void, Void Magazine, celebration of local musical talent. But up next, some great news for the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp. We'll be right back.
BritBox and PBS Passport are now offering the best of all your favorite British drama, comedy, and more when you sign up at jacksbundle.com. Start watching today.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Next time on The World, activists in Mexico lobbied their government for a decade to legalize recreational marijuana, and the Senate there has approved a bill that would make it legal. A final vote could come early next year, with plenty of restrictions. Still, Mexico could become the world's largest market for recreational weed. Our story from Mexico City, next time on The World.
Tomorrow at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, this is exciting. The Miami Marlins have extended an invitation to the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp to become their club's AAA affiliate, and this starts in the 2021 season. So the Shrimp are moving on up to the east side, and here with more on some exciting news and what it means to the Crustacean Nation, we're pleased to welcome Shrimp owner and CEO Ken Babby. He's on the line. Hey, Ken, good morning.
Hey, guys. How are you? Good morning, Melissa.
It's so good to talk to you, and congratulations. The Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp are going to be playing AAA ball. They'll be the AAA club for the Miami Marlins. How did this all come about?
You know, we're in the midst of, my goodness, so much change in 2020. I think this is just, you know, perhaps one little glimpse of positive news in a year that's been so hard for so many people and so many businesses. You know, by the time the Jumbo Shrimp take the field again in the spring. It will have been 19 months since we played a game at 1-2-1 Financial Ballpark. So, realignment, which many folks have heard of, would have happened regardless of this year and the pandemic. There were 160 minor league baseball teams across the country. Major League Baseball and its ownership group has expressed a desire to contract that down to 120 cities, and just yesterday offered license invitations to those 120 markets. And, you know, there were a lot of reasons why certain clubs were picked and others were not, mostly a function of their market size and facilities. And as we know, we have one of the best ballparks in the country, and we were incredibly flattered and honored to receive an invitation to move up to be Miami's AAA affiliate next year.
Now, I did not realize this, but this is the first time Jacksonville will field a AAA baseball team since 1968, when the former Suns, I guess, here were an affiliate of the New York Mets. And the population growth here is driving this as well, Ken. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, I think when you look at the growth of Jacksonville in the last 10 years, you know, we have we rose to be the 12th largest city in the United States. People should be really proud of our city when they hear this news of Jacksonville being extended this invitation. We know we're an NFL city. We know that the city's growing. People hear that. We certainly see the growth in terms of people moving to our region. You can see it just as you drive through town with cranes up and businesses choosing Jacksonville as new corporate homes. But this really establishes us on a different level in the sports ecosystem as the Jaguars continue to grow, and our commitment to the city, you know, was extended actually last year with a lease extension and naming rights agreement with 1-2-1 Financial. Their team has been phenomenal in supporting us. We're now able to take the next evolution of our business, and we'll be competing against teams with similar market sizes like Charlotte and Nashville and Buffalo and Indianapolis. And so we'll be competing against higher level talent, but we'll also have the best of the best from the Marlins. And we're incredibly excited about this invitation and this next step.
Sure. Now, let me ask you, of course, all of the City Hall discussions about developing Lot J right next to the ballpark are ongoing, and the whole Lot J development next to TIAA Bank Field and adjacent to your facility, it's all built as a way to really animate the sports complex overall. And so head of the Jumbo Shrimp, what are your thoughts about Lot J?
You know, we've actually come out publicly on multiple occasions in favor of the project, and I know there's some concerns. I know there's still some questions and analysis to be performed. We were very pleased to see, to see those deliberations over the last few weeks, and it's good for those questions to be asked and answered. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we believe that the legislation should pass. Have supported publicly. Actually, I spoke at City Council just 3 weeks ago, and have been in close contact with our council representatives as well as the Jaguars. This is good for downtown, and I would just add that, you know, if you're going to make an investment to be a first-rate city, a first-rate sports complex, a first-rate entertainment district, of which the Jumbo Shrimp play a huge role in that process, with not only our 70 home games each year, but other events, movie nights, festivals, beer fests, concerts, all sorts of different things that we've done at the ballpark over the last few years. You're talking about a facility at 1-2-1 Financial Ballpark that's going to be activated almost 200 nights a year. And so that's something that we think is good for the community, and the Lot J development that the Jaguars and Shad Khan have proposed would only add to that environment and make Jacksonville a better place to work, live, and play.
By the way, our director, Josh, wants to make sure you don't get rid of Thirsty Thursday. He's asked me to mention that to you.
No, I can tell you Thirsty Thursday is not going anywhere. In fact, I've shared this story program before. Yeah, I've shared this on your program before. In fact, when I purchased the team at the very first press conference, I think before I even was able to speak, the press located at the press conference had three people yelled out, "What are you going to do about Thirsty Thursday?" And I think the moment that I said Thirsty Thursday was unchanged and would continue for generations to come. Everybody was at ease.
Yeah,
you know,
there was much rejoicing. Yeah. Well, you know, you've done an excellent job of really making the experience family friendly and fun. That's really the appeal of minor league baseball, is kind of the wackiness of it, the fun, silly things that go on in and around a game, and events that can happen at the ballpark even when there's not a game. So how do you plan on continuing that tradition in the new season?
Well, the great news as it relates to that is our strategy in providing great, affordable family, and yes, even quirky fun for our community in Northeast Florida is not changing. In fact, it's our hallmark. It's what we've built our business around. It's what our fans have grown to expect after these last 5 years. We believe created a business and a more importantly an experience for families that is become quintessential with Jacksonville. And so absolutely, you know, continuing that affordability, continuing the right way to drive that experience. You know, one of my favorite compliments people give about our experience is they come to a jumbo shrimp game and they have so much fun that they leave without even knowing the score or in some cases who won or lost. Mm-hmm. And that to me is an indication of not only us delivering a great experience and a wonderful time, but doing it the right way. And in 2021, it'll be doing it the safe and right way.
Let's talk about that. You'll be putting out a schedule for the new AAA team shortly, with tickets going on sale pretty soon. So how can people be part of the new season?
Yeah, the best way to stay in touch with the team, and I think we've talked about it, is just to stay close on jackshrimp.com. And you can certainly, engage with the team on all of our forms of social media. In fact, it's been really fun the last 24 hours. We've all needed some good news in 2020. Certainly, if you're owning or running a baseball team, you've been scratched. You know, as I said to somebody last night, it's been like walking in the desert the last few months, looking for just a cold drink of water. And I think yesterday's invitation was some positive news that we've all so badly wanted in the midst of a tough year. But yeah, stay in touch with our team on Twitter, on Facebook, Instagram, and on our website. You'll be able to see the schedule the moment it comes out. I anticipate there'll be tremendous pent-up demand for people who want to come out and get to ball games this spring and this summer. And so you'll certainly want to stay in touch with us. And I would anticipate that release here shortly.
Excellent. Well, congrats, Ken. I'm so happy for you and the team. It's really great news, as you said, that we could all use right now. So have a great holiday, and we'll see you in the spring to play ball.
Thank you so much, Melissa. We'll see you guys soon. Thanks for the support.
He's Jumbo Shrimp owner and CEO Ken Babby. Again, that's jackshrimp.com. Well, in a moment, filling the audio void with the music of some Duval musical stars. We'll take a listen after this.
Congaree & Penn Landscape Trees, Jacksonville's family-owned large tree installation, relocation, and comprehensive landscape installer. More info and appointments available at congareetrees.com or 527-1945. Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and services tailored for active retirees. Information at vickerslanding.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Holiday shopping helps share the joy of the season with family and friends, but some toys are defective. Our website has links to help avoid dangerous toys.
More at terrellhogan.com.
Escape to a world of British telly on BritBox and PBS Passport when you become a supporter of WJCT. Sign up at jacksbundle.com today.
I'm Robin Young. The number of Americans hospitalized for COVID-19 has shattered records every day this week. What about the toll on people taking care of them? We'll speak with a psychiatrist who staffs a physician hotline talking to COVID care workers about anxiety, rage, sometimes at people who don't believe what they're dying from. Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
For the holidays, is the at-home DNA test kit the gift that keeps on giving?
We literally went back to the great-great-great-grandfather with individuals that were born in the early part of the 1800s.
But what do you get for your money? And who might you be giving your information to? Finding family and keeping it to yourself. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville continues to loom large in popular music, which means it's time for the audio void to turn up the volume on the beautiful noise coming out of Northeast Florida. Audio Void, brought to you by Void Magazine, is also part of our Jacksonville music experience here at WJCT. Editor Matt Shaw is on the line to spin some great local music created by local artists, and they are making noise on the national stage right now. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
Good to talk to you. Okay, so this is a monthly thing you're doing at Void Magazine, curating local musicians and bands so we can all enjoy their work. So who do you have spinning this month?
So I wanted to talk about artists who are kind of making noise on the national stage and getting national attention right now. As you said, artists from Jacksonville and Northeast Florida have kind of always been part of the popular music conversation, from the Allman Brothers and Southern Rock in the 60s and 70s to hip-hop acts like Quad City DJs in the 90s, and even like punk pop-punk groups like Yellow Card and Section 12 in the early 2000s. And so I've got three groups, three artists today that are kind of doing that right now, reverberating across the nation. I think we're going to start with Love Culture. Is that right?
Okay, let's start with Love Culture. Tell us about Love Culture.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite groups making music right now. It's a five-person hip-hop collective. They fit in really nicely together. They've got great energy, and it's kind of emblematic. Their music is emblematic of the hip-hop that's being made today. It's inventive sampling, progressive, fun lyrics. They've got that braggadocious flow, but kind of like Kendrick Lamar, J. Cole, they're comfortable addressing like their vulnerabilities, which I think is really cool. And the song Slap 5, they have an ambassadorship with Sprite. And so they're kind of blowing up right now. And so I wanted to listen to the track Slap 5 from their latest release called Volume 2. Let's listen to that.
Hey, a red or blue pill, feel sick, this is real rap. I heal my truth, sit in silence, I let my fears nap. Blessed by the aces, gotta play and let it roll. I be a sun, don't shine forever, moon illuminates my soul, yeah. A trooper told, I hope the smashes find you well. They isolate the vessels with the frequency.
All right, nice. And there's a cool video to go along with this too, Matt says. Okay, yeah. Just a few minutes left. Let's talk about local musician and producer Rania Woodard and Brian Squillace and Land.
Yeah. Yep, Renia Woodard and Brian Squillace is a duo that make electronic pop using like really inventive samples like tree branches for percussion. They really have a signature sound, and in maybe April they threw away an entire new album and just started from scratch. And the new album's called Lotus. A song called OOW, which I want to listen to, is making noise right now. And they Renia just did an interview with Vanity Fair, which is online right now. So let's listen to OOW.
They sound so fresh, and that's cool to see them getting a lot of national attention, Matt. Okay.
Very cool.
Again. One more track. It's Uno. Tell us quickly about Uno.
Melissa, I know you know. you had on the show some time back, but 2018, he popped up out of his bedroom.
He makes music in his bedroom, yeah.
Yeah, in kind of obscurity, and then he signed to Seattle label Sub Pop, which is famous for unearthing bands like Nirvana and Soundgarden, and today is probably one of the most recognizable indie labels in the world. He did a cover of a song called Zebra from Baltimore dream pop duo called Beach House, who I really love, and Uno's version is extra cozy. It's kind of like a fluffy cloud pillow, so I wanted to listen to Zebra this morning.
Beautiful. So this gives everyone a sense of the amazing local talent here in Duval that is getting signed to major labels, getting national publicity. And kudos to you, Matt Shaw. It's all on the Audio Void at Void Magazine's website. We'll also include it in our Jacksonville Music Experience music channels online and on our HD channels over the air terrestrial radio. Matt, thank you so much for sharing all this beautiful music with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa. My pleasure.
And we'll close with a little more of Lands. That is a great tune, too. Let's listen to that one again. I really love hearing all these local musicians make noise and get attention. It's so exciting. So enjoy the music. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Roundtable. Have a great day.
Take me back in time.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.